So I want to start by talking about what meta actually is, because for some of you this might be new territory. The word meta is Pali, and it's usually translated as loving kindness. Sometimes also you'll see translated as goodwill. But loving kindness is the normal one. And there's this thing about the word love. I want to talk with this right away. So this isn't love as it's generally used in our culture. So we're not talking about emotional connection to another person. That's how love is often described in our culture. Or we use it even more simply as in, oh, I love New York, or I love chocolate, right? So we're not talking about that, that kind of love, strong attachment to. Instead, what we're talking about here is loving kindness. So this is a expression of the heart to feel goodwill towards others, towards ourselves and others. And we'll talk more about the varying layers of that as we go through the course. But I want to make sure you understand that that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about love. I was a hippie. I know all about that love thing. But this is loving kindness. It's a very different energy we're talking about. This is a wholesome mind state. It's one of what are called the Brahma Viharas in Theravada tradition. You also see them called the Four Jewels in other traditions, for instance. And the reason, why is it I want to teach this? Why is this so important? This is one of two threads of Buddhist meditation teaching in the Theravada tradition that I've been practicing now for about 18 years. And I find that metta can, at times in my life, it's been really skillful for me to make metta my primary, in fact, sometimes, in fact, first. Long periods of time, my only practice. But why now? Why is it so important right now? Well, I'll tell you a little funny story about 2 years ago, or a bit more than 2 years ago, when the pandemic started. I found myself walking around singing this old song from the 60s, early 70s. I think it was Dusty Springfield. And the song goes, "What the world needs now is love, sweet love. That's the only thing that there's not enough of." Right? So this is like, oh, this was telling me something. Now, you need to teach metta. And I already taught this whole course about 15 months ago, and I'm teaching it again for exactly the same reason. We're in this time in the world where things are really difficult. And if you live in Boulder, or even more, if you live in Superior or Louisville, you really know how tough it is right now. But it's like, in general, the world is in a very difficult place politically, socially, ecologically. And we need to sort of have that heart energy energized, turned on, increased, focused. And that's what metta does. In the other form of meditation that you may be more familiar with, in the Theravada form of insight meditation, or sometimes called mindfulness, or in other traditions called other things, shamatha and vipassana in other traditions, for instance. The idea is to learn to understand how the mind works and see how the mind continually is creating unwholesome mind states. And then by learning to see that, you then learn to skillfully shift the mind to wholesome mind states. So it's a sort of long, slow, somewhat intellectual process, I would say. Metta goes, nah, why go to all that trouble? Why not just accept the fact that your mind is often full of unwholesome mind states, and instead consciously choose to fill it with wholesome mind states. So the whole idea behind metta practice is to just continually over and over and over and over and over again put wholesome mind states into play by having consciously having wholesome thoughts. And we'll talk more about that, a lot about that over the next 8 weeks. But that's the idea behind it. So it's a different approach to meditative practice. And because we're trying to do this continuously, it takes a lot of concentration. A lot of concentration. This is not, it sounds like on one level, gee, just sort of Pollyannish, sort of like, oh, sweet. Ugh. In fact, when I first encountered metta, my reaction was, ugh, this sort of, hippy dippy, sweet affirmation stuff. And I was a serious meditator, right? But I become much more deeply involved in metta practice as my life has gone on and on. And it's just such a wonderful practice. It's not at all hippy dippy at all. Having been in the world of hippy dippy practices for a long time too. So I can tell you it's definitely not that. And the here's the thing. This is a way of sort of consciously connecting to other beings. Eventually, we get to the point where we're trying to consciously connect to all beings. Like that's the end point of this practice. So about 7 weeks from now, we'll be talking about that. But it's like, that's the idea. The idea is that we don't exclude anyone, that we have this, not only do we have feelings of loving kindness, we have loving kindness for everyone. Wow. That's a tall order, as they say. But it starts by finding a group of people and practicing with them and then practicing on your own. And this is, I want to read something from the sutta here. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, which is the collected discourses. And this is a lovely little verse I love, where Ananda, who is the attendant of the Buddha, is come to the Buddha and is asking a question. Says, "Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life, that is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." And the Buddha replies, "Not so, Ananda, not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life. Ananda, this is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu, that's us, has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path." So this practice is about making connection, consciously making connection to a broader group. And this sangha that we're creating here right now is one such broad group where we can actually connect together in this wholesome way. So it's a very, I'm just trying to point out how traditional this is. I mean, this is like something the Buddha talked about a lot. You'll see references to this whole story of metta over and over again in various teachings of the Buddha. But I think it's also interesting to look at, I'm going to talk about the Metta Sutta in a second. And so the question is, well, where did this come from? What's the story behind the Metta Sutta, which is the Buddha's primary teaching on loving kindness? It's quite an interesting story. The Buddha would take his followers, his students, out into the world, out into the forest, and then go to some local village to go for alms, and then they would go back to the forest, and then he'd send them out into the forest. Everybody go sit by themselves and find a nice tree to sit underneath, or whatever they had. Some had little kutirs they would sit in. Get out there into the world of the, this sort of forest. And they were in this one particular place, and the Buddha had done this, and they'd all the students had gone out and sat in the forest for the day, and they all came back, and they were really, really afraid. They were really scared. And the Buddha said, "What's going on, guys?" And he said, "Well," they said, "well, you know, this forest is full of evil tree spirits. And they're really scary, and they're trying to, you know, get us to leave." And they were all like really, really frightened. Set aside your oh my god tree spirits idea, but the idea that it was just a really, really scary place. Okay. Something about that. And we may have even been in the forest that somehow it has that sort of creepy feeling to it. And so the Buddha taught them metta. So metta, the original idea behind metta, was a way to overcome fear. Which is, think about that. This is a way to actually overcome fear. What motivates us often in our lives is we're afraid. We're afraid of what's happening in the world. We're afraid of certain political or environmental or all those sort of issues that are going on. And then we get angry. So now we're full of fear and anger, two really unwholesome emotional states. And so what the Buddha said is, no, practice this way instead. And so they actually started, these guys, the next day, they went out into the forest and they practiced metta, and they all came back and they said, "This is great. Not only are the tree spirits not bothering us anymore, now they're protecting us and trying to make sure that no one else comes around and bothers us while we're practicing." So it sort of, their mind state shifted. So that's the story behind the Metta Sutta. But the Metta Sutta itself is actually not that long. And traditionally, when the Metta Sutta is taught, before the Metta Sutta would be taught, you would have to memorize it and chant it perfectly. I'm not going to ask you to do that. but I think I love this sutta, and I love to chant it. And it is one way to practice this, is simply to chant the sutta. It takes about 4 minutes. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to chant the sutta for you, just so you get a sense of the language and the flavor of this beautiful teaching. And then if you're interested in that form of practice, there is a recording of me chanting this on my website. You can go there and you can chant along with Barry every morning if you want to, or whatever you want to do there. But I thought it's quite good to actually hear this sutta. And so what I'd like to suggest you do is sort of close your eyes and just take in this sound, in a sense, and what it feels like. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their way, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state.
Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
So what I want to do now is actually go through this sutta almost line by line, and look at what the Buddha is saying here and what this means. There's an incredible amount in this short sutta. So it starts, he starts off saying, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. So first of all, he says, this is what should be done. This is not a passive process. This isn't like, well, yeah, I'm a good person, I'm okay. This is like, oh, no, let's actually consciously do something. So this is a practice. And by one who is skilled in goodness, not just something who's good, but who's actually skilled. It's someone who's consciously practices goodness. And then he says, and who knows the path of peace. Well, this is Buddhist code. The path of peace, of course, in this case is the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is for someone who knows the Noble Eightfold Path, who understands the primary teaching of the Buddha and wishes to have a heart full of loving kindness. And by actually consciously practicing. And then he goes for the next, you know, 7 or 8 lines, he goes through and explains, and this is how you should be. This is how you should be operating in the world when you do this practice. And please understand, this is aspirational. If you're not careful, this turns into, I have to be perfect before I can do this. No. This is leading towards more perfection in our lives. And so these are all pointers in a direction as opposed to hard and fast dogmatic rules. Okay. So first of all, it should be straightforward and gentle in speech. So this is right speech, which is a huge topic for the Buddha. In many cases, one part of the Eightfold Path is part of the five precepts. This is like always telling the truth, not speaking harshly, not gossiping, etc. But it's like, who's actually, as it says here, straightforward and gentle in speech. Gentle being a key word there. And he says, humble and not conceited. Humble also refers to speech, to not boasting or stretching the truth. And not conceited expresses the idea that we shouldn't think that we are better than others. Oh, I'm one of those Buddhists who practices metta. I must be really good. You know, we can get very easily get caught in that headspace too. since that idea, just that very idea, separates us from other people. And if we're trying to connect to all beings, conceit is one of the things that would separate us from them. It's it would be an unwholesome mind state. You can't have metta for people if you think you're better than them. Or, interestingly enough, if you think you're worse than them, they're equally problematic. And I want to read something. This is from the Book of Joy by the Dalai Lama. And this is a wonderful book that talks, is a series of talks, interviews, discussions that the Dalai Lama had with the very sadly, very recently late Desmond Tutu, and how they came together and talked about joy for a week. This is one thing that the Dalai Lama said that I think is very relevant to this idea of not conceited. When I meet someone, the Dalai Lama said, returning to what is becoming an important theme, I always try to relate to the person on the basic human level. On that level, I know that just like me, he or she wishes to find happiness, to have fewer problems and less difficulty in their life. Whether I am speaking with one person or whether I'm giving a talk to a large group of people, I always see myself first and foremost as just another fellow human. That way, there's in fact no need for introduction. I love that. If, on the other hand, I relate to them from the perspective of myself as someone different, a Buddhist, a Tibetan, and so on, I will then create walls to keep me apart from others. And if I relate to others, think that I am the Dalai Lama, I will create the basis for my own separation and loneliness. After all, there's only one Dalai Lama in the entire world. In contrast, if I see myself primarily in terms of myself as a human being, as a fellow human, I will then have more than 7 billion people who I can feel deep connection with. And this is wonderful, isn't it? What do you need to fear or worry about when you have 7 billion other people who are with you? So this is the mind state we're talking about. Then it goes on in the sutta. Next slide. It's contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways. But now he's talking about how we live in the world. Contented and easily satisfied is like, I don't need a lot, you know, which is of course the exact opposite of our culture. The message our culture gives us is get more stuff, right? You know, I had a student who wore this t-shirt that said, the person with the most stuff when they die wins. Which was, I thought, a really great summation of our whole culture. And so contented means you just, I have enough, I'm okay, I don't need more, things are fine. So sort of operating from that place of content and easily satisfied. And then unburdened with duties. Try not to, you know, our whole culture, once again, encourages us to be busy all the time. Do this. And we sort of get burdened by our duties, literally. And so to really practice and have a heart full of loving kindness, we have to learn how to slow down a little bit. To not, and part of that is by being frugal in our ways. The more simply we live, the less we are burdened by duties. It's a pretty straight line equation. Okay. Peaceful and calm. This is like, oh, you actually want to have a mind that's still, peaceful, calm. These are wholesome, virtuous mind states. And then he ends, this is a funny story with this. Joseph Goldstein, who I've studied with in this tradition, actually, several times, has this really funny story. He was doing a 3-month metta retreat at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And he would go for a walk every day in the neighborhood. And on this walk, there was this one farm he'd go by where there's this great big dog that would come out and bark and bark and bark and bark and bark, bark. You know, and it was kind of a big scary dog. And he was like determined not to sort of be scared of this dog and actually to have, since you're supposed to have loving kindness for all beings, even though this dog was barking at him, he was going to offer this dog thoughts of loving kindness. That's how he decided he was going to deal with the situation. So he's there, he is, he's got to this point where there's that dog again, and he's like, oh, there's that dog again. So he's feeling kind of nervous, but at the same time, he's offering the dog loving kindness, and he's getting close, the dog's getting closer, and he's going to go close to the dog, and the dog comes up and bites him on the hand. Oh, I wasn't really offering loving kindness because he was full of this ill will towards the dog, and he was just sort of mechanically saying the phrases. Because he started like, he was using it like as a way to shift the dog, to change someone else. This isn't, and this is really important, this practice isn't about changing anyone else. It's only about changing our own heart and mind. That's all it's about. It may affect others, but that's beside the point almost. What's important is that we're changing our heart and mind. And this was like for him, this was a lesson in, you know, you can't use this to change that dog or that person or whatever. You can only just do the practice. And then at the end of this list of wholesome things that we should try and cultivate, the Buddha pops in, let them not do the slightest thing that the lies would later reprove. This is the classic Buddhist thing where at the end of a long list, it says, and anything else, just in case you thought that was okay. No, that's not okay. It's like he's just sort of making sure that he's covered all his bases in a sense. And it's good, you know, we all have our own ways. We know we're not being particularly wholesome. So if I haven't hit your favorite ones yet, now the Buddha's making sure you hit them anyway. So basically, the whole start of the sutta is that we have to work, that takes effort, and we have to sort of do the best we can to live this virtuous, wholesome life and practice from that place. Then, finally we get to some instruction about the practice itself. It says, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. That's the key instruction. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. So people should be happy, they should be safe, they should live at ease. So in the classic form of this practice that I'm going to be teaching, we actually use a set of phrases. So the meditation object, as opposed to, say, our breath, if we're practicing in some sort of insight practice, is a set of actual phrases that we repeat over and over again. And this little phrases reflect this line. So we'd be saying something like, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. So the idea behind metta is that you're wishing that others have ideal conditions. I mean, think about it. If you always felt safe, happy, healthy, and you lived at ease, which means you weren't struggling to sort of just keep your life and put, you know, food on the table and a roof over your head. That's a pretty ideal life. And it's also an ideal life in terms of practice. Because if I don't have any worries, then I can focus on my practice. And the other thing I want to point out is those phrases, you can just replace the you with an I, and you can wish this for yourself. And we'll talk a lot about that next week. But that's the idea behind the practice. And then once again, there's this list here where he goes on and says, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. So this is like, oh, wait, I can't leave anybody out. No one can be left out of this process. I can't say, oh, well, I'll have loving being kindness for those people, but those people or those animals, you know, those snakes, who wants to have loving kindness? Well, they're living beings, all beings without exception. And the seen and the unseen. This is a reference to Buddhist cosmology, where there's beings we can see, and there's being in other realms that we can't see. You can take that with a grain of salt if you want. But that was what he was talking about, like the tree spirits he was talking about. And when they in that story I told you, those are beings that couldn't be seen but are experienced. Those living near and far away. Once again, this is interesting. Often, you know, when you think about who you have feelings of loving kindness towards, there are people that are close to you, people who live near you, who are part of your life. You know, that collection of friends and relatives and people you work with, and you know, maybe some of them live a little further away, but they're part of your life and you've lived with them and you know them. And that's where we normally have feelings of loving kindness towards these people. He's saying living near or far away. So wait, there are, you know, over 7 billion people in the world. Just people, let alone all the other beings, just people beings. 7 billion people. Well, most of them live far away, but we can't exclude them. So he's just repeating with different words the same idea. We can't exclude anyone. Then he says this fascinating thing, those born and to be born. In other words, those who are alive now, but also those who aren't even born yet. This could refer, and I want to be very careful here, you know, because this is such a controversial issue. This could be to the unborn, you know, where we have to be kind to the unborn, and this is a big political issue. I don't want to go there because I don't think that's what he's really talking about. He's really talking about future generations. I have to think, not when I'm having a heart full of loving kindness, I also have to think of all those beings that are going to come after me. The generations and generations of beings that are going to come after me. And so I have to, in my conscious practice of loving kindness, I have to take that into consideration. That there are people coming after me that I have to take care of in my practice. I can't ignore the fact. Well, I only have to wish for loving kindness for the people who are alive now. Those other people, well, they can figure that out later on. That's their problem, which is once again how our culture operates a lot of the time, unfortunately. This is like, no, we have to take that into consideration. This is, I've seen this applied very strongly in the ecological and environmental teachings of Buddhism, this particular line. Because really, when you think about a lot of what we're talking about in terms of environmental issues and those sorts of things, societal issues, so we're talking about the people who come after us. We're trying to make this world okay for them too. And we have to have thoughts of loving kindness towards them. That's part of what we're trying to do. So he's sort of emphasized how important it is that we take into consideration all beings. And then he says this really interesting thing. He says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. It's called the far enemy of metta. In all of the teachings that the Buddha talks about loving, of wholesome mind states, there's the mind state, then there's what's called the far enemy. The far enemy of loving kindness, of goodwill, is ill will. You know, anything, don't despise anyone in any state, let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. I mean, he's being very precise here. And this is difficult. Actually, we think, oh, well, I'm not like that, right? I've never had thoughts of ill will or harm for other people. But then, have you ever had the thought when you saw someone get their comeuppance in the world? You thought, well, she deserved that. He deserved it. That's the thought of ill will. And it's so easy for us to go there. It's so easy for us to fall into that way of thinking. And so this is something we have to be very conscious of, and so practicing metta, that we don't go to this far enemy in certain cases, about certain people, about certain classes of people, about certain political parties or certain nationalities or certain cultural issues, or, you know, all those things that divide people. That's what he's talking about here, that we can't fall into that. We have to be very conscious and aware that this is where we often quite unconsciously go if we're not careful. And it seems sort of natural, like, well, they deserve that. Well, no, they were just another human being who deserves to be, have, you know, happiness and healthiness and live with ease. That's the mind we have to shift to. Then there's this really nice section where the Buddha's talking about how strong should this practice be? How strong should the energy of this practice be? He says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. Think about that. I mean, and I want to be careful here because I know some people have very difficult relationships with their mother. And so if this, you know, if you want to replace the word mother with father or favorite aunt or something, that's fine. But it's like a mother protecting the life of her only child. That's the energy, the depth of the energy that we have to apply here. And then he goes on. So with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings with a boundless heart. And then later on, he says, outward and unbounded, when he's describing the process, the teaching, the practice, that the practice should be outwards and about. So it's going out into the world and it's unbounded. Ill will, the opposite, that far enemy, binds us. It constricts our heart. Instead of our heart being open, ill will closes and clamps down on our heart. It's a total, the opposite. So we need to be unbounded. Then he says, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. So first of all, this phrase, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, this is something that occurs in other suttas, where the Buddha is talking about meditation practice. And this is basically Buddhist code for all the time. And think about it. When are you not standing, walking, seated, or lying down? You know, today would add, or on your computer, we might want to add some, but basically we're always in one of those four, doing one of those four things. And in fact, in some places, the Buddha will add, or in any other position you find yourself, just once again, to be sure. And then whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. So we can't sort of half do this. We can't do this half-heartedly and sort of doze through it. This is something we have to be awake and alert. And then, so it's like, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. So what the Buddha is saying here is, this is how what our mind should be focused on all the time, without exception. Not only all beings, but all the time. That's the goal, in a sense, if you like to think in terms of goals of the practice, that we have this heart full of loving kindness all the time. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? And it's really hard to imagine. But there are beings that I've encountered who, if it isn't there all the time, certainly seems to be there almost all the time. I mean, very powerful people who practice for a long time. And you just feel it in them. It's a different energy these people have. I wasn't going to tell this story, but it seems like a good time to tell this story. This is on one of my retreats. One of the teachers in the evening gave a talk about gratitude practice, which is another form of wholesome mind state that you can cultivate. And one thing he suggested was that if you wanted to, you should just write down all the things you're grateful for. Now, there was a woman on this retreat. This is a big retreat, so like 90 people in the hall, right? This one woman I'd noticed many times because she looked so sad. I mean, she was like literally, she'd walk with her head down and she sort of slumped and she just had that sort of sad energy. So the next morning, when this question and answer time, which is after breakfast, teacher says, any questions? She puts up her hand right away. Oh, yeah. And he says, what's your question? She says, well, I took your advice about gratitude practice, and I started writing things down that I'm grateful for. And I've written 5 pages. Am I doing too much? And Guy, this is my teacher, Guy, turned to her and he just said, keep going. All he said, just keep going. But he said it in such a way that I'm sitting 50 feet away from him and I felt like just blasted by the loving kindness and the energy of him saying that. It was just like, poof. And she, this woman, was like just glowing for the rest of the retreat. Just like that. Now, this energy is incredibly powerful and flows out into the world and affects other people. And that's not why we do it. I want to repeat that. We do that to change our own heart minds. But when we change our own heart minds, it goes out into the world. People feel that. It's a palpable thing when you're around people who are full of loving kindness. So then the last section here of the sutta, where the Buddha is basically saying, and if you actually do this, this is what happens. He says, this is said to be the sublime abiding. So sublime, if you look that up in the dictionary, means lofty, grand, or exalted in thought, expression, or manner, and an outstanding spiritual, intellectual, or moral worth. It sounds pretty good. Right? Sublime. And it's like, it's not only is it sublime, it's a sublime abiding. Well, what's an abiding? This is another word you see a lot in the suttas. An abiding comes from the same root as abode, where we live. This is where we live in our hearts. We have this sublime abode. This practice creates this sublime abode that we can then live in and operate in the world from. Then he goes on, by not holding to fixed views. This is a really big issue in the Buddhist teachings, the idea of sort of clinging to views. You know, the second noble truth really is all about the fact that we cling to things, and one of the primary things we cling to are views and opinions. We decide this is the right way to do things, this is correct, and if you don't believe that, you're wrong. This creates more ill will and suffering in the world than pretty much anything else. Think of all the wars that are fought and have been fought over the centuries, over I have the right religion, your religion is wrong, therefore I can just do whatever I want because you're heathens. That's clinging to a view. Or maybe it's not a religious idea, it's a political idea. So by not holding to fixed views, that's part of having a heart full of loving kindness, that you don't exclude people by your views, because your views of people, you start to go, no, not them, because they're like that. That's stopping your heart from actually being full of loving kindness. So by not holding to fixed views, and he goes on to say, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires. So here we are once again back at the core of the Buddha's teachings. One who practices this matter for all beings is pure-hearted. Clarity of vision is, in other words, say having right understanding. You know, all the Buddhist practices, no matter what, come back to this deeper understanding of what are called the three characteristics. We're freed from all sense desires, refers directly to the second noble truth and the third noble truth. You know, second noble truth, clinging to things is what causes suffering. The third noble truth, stop clinging and suffering will end. And this is like freed from all sense desires. And then he says, the last line of the sutta is not born again into this world. So again, this is Buddhist code. This is like saying, this being has become enlightened. So the Buddha is quite bluntly saying, this practice of metta leads to enlightenment. This is an enlightenment path, a form of practice that leads towards that. The tricky part is, it's not born again to this world. Also has that flavor of, if we're not careful, we think, oh, it's sort of like body negative. You know, it's like, oh, there's something wrong with having a body and being in the world. And that's not what the Buddha was talking about here at all. You know, in Buddhist cosmology, basically, you know, and I don't want to go very deeply into this because this becomes a whole other talk, but basically this physical being that is existing here right now is connected to what we'll call a bundle of karmic energy. And how I lead this life affects how that bundle grows and changes. And over time, that bundle of karmic energy takes on a particular form, like the Buddha did, and comes to enlightenment. And at that point, at the end of that being's life, that energy is gone. This is just another, like everything else in the world, like everything else in existence, these bundles of karmic energy that keep taking on new forms is impermanent. And that's all the Buddha is saying here. He's not saying there's nothing wrong with having a body, or, you know, bodies are bad, or we shouldn't, you know, enjoy our bodies or anything like that. I just want to make that very clear, because this is something that is often misinterpreted in many teachings that have come from the East when people talk about this particular idea. Has nothing to do with anything other than the energy that accumulated over time and took this particular form where this person became enlightened. That energy is now done. It's achieved its purpose. It's gone at the end of that person's life. That energy no longer takes another form. It's just another impermanent happening. That's all. So I want to very briefly talk about how this practice fits into the Noble Eightfold Path. Because the Noble Eightfold Path is, remember, the very first time the Buddha taught, he taught the Four Noble Truths, the Fourth Noble Truth being the Noble Eightfold Path. And so how does this practice fit? Is this really a Buddhist practice? Very, very clearly is. So first of all, for right, the first step on the path is right understanding. Well, we know, if you were paying attention to your mind while we were sitting at the beginning of this time, that our mind isn't always full of thoughts of loving kindness. Our mind is often full of things that are less wholesome. And if you didn't experience that tonight, I'm sure you experienced it sometime during the day because you're a human being and we all go to those places, right? And so we know that's true. We have right understanding. And so what we're going to do is choose this practice that literally fills our mind with thoughts, a wholesome mind state, over and over and over and over and over. That's the idea of the practice. And then right intention, wholesome intention, the second step on the Eightfold Path, we're choosing consciously to change those patterns by doing this practice. This practice is a way to consciously shift our habitual mental habits. Right speech, skillful speech. Well, though we're not actually saying these things out loud, this is all about repeating words. This is speech, even though it's silent. Right? It's a form of using words as a meditation object. And so this is very skillful speech. Then we have right effort. This is not a passive practice. You know, this takes a lot of effort. You know, when you start actually practicing, you'll see. If we're going to repeat these phrases over and over and over and over again without pausing, it takes a lot of effort. But this is like wholesome effort. You know, one of the part of the definition of right effort is to do what we can to create the causes and conditions such that a wholesome mind state will arise. So doing this practice creates the causes and conditions such that the mind state of loving kindness, which is an actual wholesome mind state, will actually arise. So the practice is creating this space where this energy can arise. And then by continuing to do the practice, we are fulfilling the fourth step of right effort, which is if a wholesome mind state has arisen, do what you can to keep it going. So this is very clearly right effort. And as I've said several times, this is definitely concentration. This is right concentration. Because it takes a lot of concentration to keep those phrases flowing. As we go deeper into the practice, you'll start to see how that those phrases start to get a bit more complicated as well. So there's layers to the practice that require more and more concentration. What about mindfulness? Just, you know, that's a whole other step. How does mindfulness fit in here? Remember that one of the translations of sati, which usually gets translated as mindfulness, is simply remembering. And what we're going to be doing is constantly trying to remember to keep saying the phrases. So we're really being quite mindful. We're remembering over and over and over again, and at the same time, remembering the meanings of these phrases. We'll talk a lot more about this next week, but there's definitely mindfulness involved in this practice. It's just like mindfulness used to create the causes and conditions for these phrases to keep going We need mindfulness to make that happen. Okay. So that's what I want to say about metta tonight. This is sort of the, and I wanted to do this first because I wanted to make sure you sort of understood the background of this practice. Like, where is this practice coming from? And what's the, how, the ideas behind it? Because the next 7 weeks of this course, I just put all my time and energy into simply teaching you the practice itself. Because the practice itself is quite progressive, step by step by step. And every week we'll add in another layer of it. It's quite wonderful and addictive. So that's my plan for the... Okay, so I have, those of you who know me and have practiced with me before know how addicted I am to poetry. And, I want to read this small poem that I think sums up metta in a very beautiful way. This is from a book called The Gift, poems by Hafiz. Hafiz was a Sufi poet of the same generation as Rumi, but somewhat less well known. And I think he has this beautiful language. That, now this is in translation, of course, from the Farsi that it was originally written in. This is a poem called, If God Invited You to a Party. Hafiz has a sense of humor. If God invited you to a party and said, everyone in the ballroom tonight will be my special guest, how would you treat them when you arrived? Indeed, indeed. And Hafiz knows there is no one in this world who is not upon his jeweled dance floor. This is metta. I'll read it again. If God invited you to a party and said, everyone in the ballroom tonight will be my special guest, how would you then treat them when you arrived? Indeed, indeed. And Hafiz knows there is no one in this world who is not upon his jeweled dance floor. So that's tonight's talk. I would just like to do a dedication of merit and maybe talk a little tiny bit afterwards. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.